half-hour of Mind Waves. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This Mind Web story is from the best from fantasy and science fiction, 12th series edited by Avram Davidson. It's a tale by Theodore L. Thomas titled Test. Robert Proctor was a good driver for so young a man. The turnpike curved gently ahead of him, lightly traveled on this cool morning in May. He felt relaxed and alert. 2 hours of driving had not yet produced the twinges of fatigue that appeared first in the muscles at the base of the neck. The sun was bright, but not glaring, and the air smelled fresh and clean. He breathed it deeply and blew it out noisily. It was a good day for driving. He glanced quickly at the slim, gray-haired woman sitting in the front seat with him. Her mouth was curved in a quiet smile. She watched the trees and the fields slip by on her side of the pike. Robert Proctor immediately looked back at the road.
Enjoying it, Mom?
Oh, yes, Robert. Very pleasant to sit here. I was thinking of the driving I did for you when you were little. I wonder if you enjoyed that as much as I enjoy this.
Oh, sure I did.
His mother reached over and patted him gently on the arm and then turned back to the scenery. He listened to the smooth purr of the engine. Up ahead, he saw a great truck spouting a geyser of smoke as it sped along the turnpike. Behind it, not passing it, was a long, blue convertible, content to drive in the wake of the truck. Robert Proctor noted the arrangement and filed it in the back of his mind. He was slowly overtaking them, but he would not reach them for another minute or two. He listened to the purr of the engine, and he was pleased with the sound. He had tuned that engine himself over the objections of the mechanic. The engine idled rough now, but it ran smoothly at high speed. You needed a special feel to do good work on engines, and Robert Proctor knew he had it. No one in the world had a feel like his for the tune of an engine. It was a good morning for driving, and his mind was filled with good thoughts. He pulled nearly abreast of the blue convertible and began to pass it. His speed was a few miles per hour above the turnpike limit, but his car was under perfect control. The blue convertible suddenly swung out from behind the truck. It swung out without warning and struck his car on the near right front fender, knocking his car to the shoulder on the left side of the turnpike lane. Robert Proctor was a good driver, too wise to slam on the brakes. He fought the steering wheel to hold the car on a straight path. The left wheel sank into the soft left shoulder, and the car tugged and pulled to the left and crossed the island and entered the lanes, carrying the cars heading in the opposite direction. He held it. Then the wheel struck a rock buried in the soft dirt, and the left front tire blew out. The car slewed, and it was then that his mother began to scream. The car turned sideways and skidded part of the way out into the other lanes. Robert Proctor fought against the steering wheel to straighten the car, but the drag of the blown tire was too much. The scream rang steadily in his ears, and even as he strained at the wheel, one part of his mind wondered coolly how a scream could so long be sustained without a breath. An oncoming car struck his radiator from the side and spun him viciously full into the left-hand lanes. He was flung into his mother's lap, and she was thrown against the right door it held. With his left hand, he reached for the steering wheel and pulled himself erect against the force of the spin. He turned the wheel to the left and tried to stop the spin and careen out of the lanes of oncoming traffic. His mother was unable to right herself. She lay against the door, her cry rising and falling with the eccentric spin of the car. The car lost some of its momentum. During one of the spins, he twisted the wheel straight, and the car wobblingly stopped spinning and headed down the lane. Before Robert Proctor could turn it off the pike to safety, a car loomed ahead of him, bearing down on him. There was a man at the wheel of the other car, sitting rigid, unable to move, eyes wide and staring and filled with fright. Alongside the man was a girl, her head against the back of the seat, soft curls framing a lovely face, her eyes closed in easy sleep. It was not the fear in the man that reached into Robert Proctor. It was the trusting helplessness in the face of the sleeping girl. The two cars sped closer to each other, and Robert Proctor could not change the direction of his car. The driver of the other car remained frozen at the wheel. At the last moment, Robert Proctor sat motionless, staring into the face of the onrushing sleeping girl, his mother's cry still sounding in his ears. He heard no crash when the two cars collided head-on at a high rate of speed. He felt something push into his stomach, and the world began to go gray. Just before he lost consciousness, he heard the scream stop, and he knew then that he had been hearing a single short-lived scream that had only seemed to drag on and on. There came a painless wrench, and then darkness. Robert Proctor seemed to be at the bottom of a deep black well. There was a spot of faint light in the far distance, and he could hear the rumble of a distant voice. He tried to pull himself toward the light and the sound, but the effort was too great. He lay still, gathered himself, and tried again. The light grew brighter and the voice louder. He tried harder again, and he drew closer. Then he opened his eyes full and looked at the man sitting in front of him.
You all right, son?
The man wore a blue uniform, and his round, beefy face was familiar. Robert Proctor tentatively moved his head and discovered he was seated in a reclining chair, unharmed, and able to move his arms and legs with no trouble. He looked around the room, and then he remembered. The man in the uniform saw the growing intelligence in his eyes.
No harm done, son. You just took the last part of your driver's test.
Robert Proctor focused his eyes on the man. And though he saw the man clearly, he seemed to see the faint face of the sleeping girl in front of him. The uniformed man continued to speak.
We put you through an accident under hypnosis. Do it to everybody these days before they can get their driver's licenses. Makes better drivers of them, more careful drivers the rest of their lives. Remember it now? Coming in here and all?
Robert Proctor nodded, thinking of the sleeping girl. She never would have awakened. She would have passed right from a sweet temporary sleep into the dark, heavy sleep of death. Nothing in between. His mother would have been bad enough. After all, she was pretty old. The sleeping girl was downright waste. The uniformed man was still speaking.
So you're all set now. You pay me the $10 fee and sign this application, and we'll have your license in the mail in a day or two.
He did not look up. Robert Proctor placed a $10 bill on the table in front of him, glanced over the application, and signed it. He looked up to find two white uniformed men standing one on each side of him, and he frowned in annoyance. He started to speak, but the uniformed man spoke first.
Sorry, son. You failed. You're sick. You need treatment.
The two men lifted Robert Proctor to his feet, and he said,
take your hands off me. What is this?
The uniformed man said,
nobody should want to drive a car after going through what you just went through. It should take months before you can even think of driving again, but you're ready right now. Killing people doesn't bother you. We don't let your kind run around loose in society anymore. But don't you worry now, son. They'll take good care of you, and they'll fix you up.
He nodded to the two men, and they began to march Robert Proctor out. At the door, he spoke, and his voice was so urgent, the two men paused. Robert Proctor said,
you can't really mean this. I'm still dreaming, aren't I? This is still part of the test, isn't it?
How do any of us know?
And they dragged Robert Proctor out the door, knees stiff, feet dragging, his rubber heels sliding along the two grooves worn into the floor. That story was titled Test, written by Theodore L. Thomas. It appeared in a collection by Avram Davidson, the 12th series of The Best from Fantasy and Science Fiction. Joining me in the reading were Cliff Roberts, Jay Fitz, and Carrie Frumpkin. This story comes from the volume Science Fiction Hall of Fame, the greatest science fiction stories of all time, a book edited by Robert Silverberg, based on stories selected by members of the Science Fiction Writers of America. It's a tale that first appeared in 1953, Arthur C. Clarke's The 9 Billion Names of God.
This is a highly unusual request. As far as I know, it's the first time anyone's been asked to supply a Tibetan monastery with an automatic sequence computer. I don't want to sound inquisitive, but, well, I should hardly have thought that your establishment had much use for such a machine. Could you explain just what you intend to do with it?
Gladly,
replied the Lama, readjusting his silk robes and carefully putting away the slide rule that he had been using for currency conversions. He went on to say,
Dr. Wagner, your Mark V computer can carry out any routine mathematical operation involving up to 10 digits. However, for our work, we're interested in letters, not numbers. As we wish you to modify the output circuits, the machine will be printing words, not columns of figures.
I don't quite understand.
Well, this is a project on which we have been working for the last 3 centuries, since the Lamasery was founded, in fact. It is somewhat alien to your way of thought, so I hope you will listen with an open mind while I explain it.
Naturally.
It is really quite simple. We have been compiling a list which shall contain all the possible names of God.
I beg your pardon?
We have reason to believe that all such names can be written with not more than 9 letters in an alphabet that we have devised.
And you have been doing this for 3 centuries?
Yes, we expected it would take us about 15,000 years to complete the task.
I see now why you wanted to hire one of our machines, but exactly what is the purpose of this project?
The Lama hesitated for a fraction of a second, and Dr. Wagner wondered if he had offended him. If so, there was no trace of annoyance in the reply.
Call it ritual, if you like, but it is a fundamental part of our belief. All the many names of the Supreme Being, God, Jehovah, Allah, and so on, they are only man-made labels. There is a philosophical problem of some difficulty here, which I do not propose to discuss, but somewhere among all the possible combinations of letters that can occur are what one may call the real names of God. By systematic permutation of letters, we have been trying to list them all.
Oh, I see. You've been starting at A-A-A-A-A-A and working your way up to Z, 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 Z.
Exactly, Dr. Wagner. Though we use a special alphabet of our own, modifying the electromatic typewriters to deal with this is, of course, trivial. A rather more interesting problem is that of devising suitable circuits to eliminate ridiculous combinations. For example, no letter must occur more than 3 times in succession.
Three? Surely you mean 2.
Three is correct, Doctor. I'm afraid it would take too long to explain why, even if you understood our language.
I'm sure it would. Go on.
Well, luckily it will be a simple matter to adapt your automatic sequence computer for this work, since once it has been programmed properly, it will permute each letter in turn and print the result. What would have taken us 15,000 years, it'll be able to do in 100 days.
Dr. Wagner was scarcely conscious of the faint sounds from the Manhattan streets far below. He was in a different world, a world of natural, not man-made mountains. High up in their remote areas, these monks had been patiently at work, generation after generation, compiling their lists of meaningless words. Was there any limit to the follies of mankind? Still, he must give no hint of his inner thoughts. The customer was always right.
There is no doubt that we can supply the Mark V to print lists of the nature you speak of. I'm much more concerned about the problem of installation and maintenance. Getting out to Tibet in these days is, well, it's not going to be easy.
We can arrange that, Doctor. The components are small enough, to travel by air. That's one reason why we selected your machine. If you can get them to India, we will provide transport from there.
And you want to hire two of our engineers?
Yes, for the 3 months that the project should occupy.
I've no doubt that personnel can manage that. There are just two other points.
Before he could finish the sentence, the Lama had produced a small slip of paper. This is my certified credit balance at the Asiatic Bank.
Oh, thank you. It appears to be adequate. The second matter is so trivial, I hesitate to mention it, but it's surprising how often the obvious gets overlooked, you know. What sort of electrical energy do you have?
A diesel generator providing 50 kilowatts at 110 volts. It was installed about 5 years ago, Doctor, and is quite reliable. It's made life at the monastery much more comfortable. But of course it was really installed to provide power for the motors driving the prayer wheels.
Oh, of course, I should have thought of that.
The view from the parapet was vertiginous, but in time one gets used to anything. After 3 months, George Henley was not impressed by the 2,000-foot swoop into the abyss or the remote checkerboard of fields in the valley below. He was leaning against the wind-smoothed stones and staring morosely at the distant mountains whose names he had never bothered to discover. This, thought George, was the craziest thing that had ever happened to him. Project Shangri-La, some wetback at the labs, had christened it. For weeks now, the Mark V had been churning out acres of sheets covered with gibberish. Patiently, inexorably, the computer had been rearranging letters in all their possible combinations, exhausting each class before going on to the next. As the sheets had emerged from the electromagnetic typewriters, the monks had carefully cut them up and pasted them into enormous books. In another week, heaven be praised, they would have finished. Just what obscure calculations had convinced the monks that they needn't bother to go on to words of 10, 20, or 100 letters, well, George didn't know. Some of his recurring nightmares consisted of, well, there might be some change of plan, and that the High Lama, whom they'd naturally called Sam Jaffe, though he didn't look like him a bit, would suddenly announce that the project would be extended to approximately A.D. 2060. They were quite capable of it. George heard the heavy wooden door slam in the wind as Chuck came out onto the parapet beside him. As usual, Chuck was smoking one of the cigars that made him so popular with the monks, who it seemed were quite willing to embrace all the minor and most of the major pleasures of life. There was one thing in their favor. They might be crazy, but they were not blue noses. Those frequent trips they took down to the village, for instance.
Listen, George, I've learned something that means trouble.
Well, what's wrong? Isn't the machine behaving?
That was the worst contingency George could imagine. It might delay his return. Nothing could be more horrible. The way he felt now, even the sight of a TV commercial would seem like manna from heaven. At least it would be some link with home.
No, it's nothing like that, George. I've just found out what all this is about.
Well, what do you mean? I thought we knew.
Sure, we know that the monks are trying to do something, and we know what it is, we think, but we don't know why. See, it's the craziest thing.
Tell me something new.
But you see, old Sam's just come clean with me. You know the way he drops in every afternoon to watch the sheets roll out? Well, this time he seemed rather excited, or at least as near as he'll ever get to it. And when I told him that we were on the last cycle, well, he asked me if I'd ever wondered what they were trying to do. I said, sure, and he told me.
Well, go on, I'll buy it.
Well, they believe that when they've listed all his names, and they reckon that there are about 9 billion of them, God's purpose will be achieved. The human race will have finished what it was created to do, and there won't be any point in carrying on. In fact, the very idea is something like a blasphemy.
Then what do they expect us to do, commit suicide?
There's no need for that. When the list's completed, God steps in and simply winds things up. You know, bingo, that's it.
Oh, yeah, I get it. When we finish our job, it'll be the end of the world.
Well, that's just what I said to Sam. And you know what happened? He looked at me in a very queer way, like I'd been stupid in class or something, and said, it's nothing as trivial as that.
Well, that's what I call taking a wide view. But what do you suppose we should do about it? I don't see that it makes the slightest difference to us. You know, after all, we already knew they were crazy.
Yeah, but don't you see what may happen? When the list is complete and the last trump doesn't blow or whatever it is they expect, we may get the blame. See, it's our machine they're using. I don't like the situation one little bit at all.
Yeah, gee, well, you got a point there, but this sort of thing's happened before, you know. When I was a kid down in Louisiana, Chuck, we had a crackpot preacher who once said the world was going to end next Sunday. Hundreds of people believed him, even sold their homes, yet when nothing happened, they didn't turn nasty, as you'd expect. No, they just decided that he'd made a mistake in his calculations, and they went right on believing. I guess some of them still do.
Well, this isn't Louisiana, in case you haven't looked, George. There are just two of us, and hundreds of those monks. I like them, and I'll be sorry for old Sam when his life work backfires on him, but all the same, I wish I was somewhere else.
Yeah, I've been wishing that for weeks, but there's nothing we can do until the contract's finished and the transport arrives to fly us out.
Of course, we could always try a bit of sabotage.
Yeah, like hell we could. That would make things worse.
Not the way I meant, George. Look at it like this. The machine will finish its run 4 days from now on the present 24 hours a day basis. The transport calls in a week. Okay, then all we need to do is find something that needs replacing during one of the overhaul periods. You know, something that'll hold up the works for a couple of days. We'll fix it, of course, but not too quickly. And if we time matters properly, we can be down at the airfield when the last name pops out of the register. They won't be able to catch us then.
No, I don't like it. It'll be the first time I ever walked out on a job. Besides, it would make them suspicious. No, Chuck, I'll sit tight and take what comes.
7 days later, as the tough little mountain ponies carried them down the winding road, George said,
I still don't like it. And don't you think I'm running away because I'm afraid. I'm just sorry for those poor old guys up there. I don't want to be around when they find what suckers they've been. I wonder how Sam will take it.
It's funny, you know, but when I said goodbye, I got the idea he knew we were walking out on him, and that he didn't really care because he knew the machine was running smoothly and that the job would soon be completed. After that, well, of course, for him, there just isn't any after that.
George turned in his saddle and started back up the mountain road. This was the last place from which one could get a clear view of the lamasery. The squat, angular buildings were silhouetted against the afterglow of the sunset. Here and there, lights gleamed like portholes in the side of an ocean liner. Electric lights, of course, sharing the same circuit as the Mark V. How much longer would they share it, wondered George. Would the monks smash up the computer in their rage and disappointment? Or would they just sit down quietly and begin their calculations all over again? He knew exactly what was happening up on the mountain at this very moment. The High Lama and his assistants would be sitting in their silk robes, inspecting the sheets as the junior monks carried them away from the typewriters and pasted them into the great volumes. No one would be saying anything. The only sound would be the incessant patter, the never-ending rainstorm of keys hitting the paper. The Mark V itself was utterly silent as it flashed through its thousands of calculations a second. 3 months of this, thought George, was enough to start anyone climbing up the wall.
Hey, George, there she is. Ain't she beautiful?
She certainly was, George thought. A battered old DC-3 lay at the end of the runway like a tiny silver cross. In 2 hours, she would be bearing them away to freedom and sanity. It was a thought worth savoring like a fine liqueur. George let it roll around in his mind as the pony trudged patiently down the slope. The swift night of the high Himalayas was now almost upon them. Fortunately, the road was very good as roads went in that region, and they were both carrying torches. There was not the slightest danger, only a certain discomfort from the bitter cold. The sky overhead was perfectly clear and ablaze with the familiar, friendly stars. At least there would be no risk, thought George, of the pilot being unable to take off because of weather conditions. That had been his only remaining worry. George began to sing, but gave it up after a while. This vast arena of mountains gleaming like whitely hooded ghosts on every side did not encourage such ebullience. Presently, George glanced at his watch.
Chuck should be there in an hour. I wonder if the computer's finished its run. It was due about now.
Chuck didn't reply, so George swung around in his saddle. He could just see Chuck's face, a white oval, turned toward the sky.
Hey, George, look!
George lifted his eyes to heaven.
there is always a last time for everything. Overhead, without any fuss, the stars were going out. The 9 billion names of God. A story written by Arthur C. Clarke, first published in 1953. It appears in the collection edited by Robert Silverberg, Science Fiction Hall of Fame. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production for MindWebs by Steve Gordon. MindWebs is produced at WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.